From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The IRS is under fire. News last week that it targeted conservative and Tea Party groups seeking nonprofit status. Now the Justice Department is investigating. It is firestorm time for the Obama administration. This hour, On Point, political scandal over the IRS and grappling with the dark money in American politics. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. How could this happen? How do you read the problem, the politics here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And later this hour, Super First Amendment attorney Floyd Abrams joins us to look at the Justice Department's snooping on the Associated Press. The Justice Department says national security. Almost everyone else says unprecedented offense. But joining me first from Washington on the IRS front is Reed Epstein, White House correspondent for Politico. Reed, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you.
Where does this thing stand? It just blew up in recent days. So much heat around this. Everybody's responding now. The president and lots of Republicans condemning what happened with the IRS. Where do things stand, Reed?
Well, finally, late last night, we got a definitive statement from President Obama that this incident happened, that in which IRS officials targeted some Tea Party and conservative groups for extra scrutiny for their nonprofit status that wasn't necessarily received by liberal groups, and he said that he's directed the Treasury Secretary Jack Lew to hold people accountable, and the implication being that heads are going to have to roll over this.
The president saying the IRS must apply the law in a fair and impartial way and its employees must act with utmost integrity. And here's more from the joint press conference with British Prime Minister David Cameron. This was on Monday, saying he won't tolerate the IRS targeting conservative groups.
I can tell you that if you've got the IRS operating in anything less than a neutral and nonpartisan way, then that is outrageous. It is contrary to our traditions, and people have to be held accountable, and it's got to be fixed.
We'll look at how that fix might happen. Republicans and many others really up in arms about this. Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, here on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday, saying the IRS targeting conservative groups is absolutely chilling.
This is truly outrageous, and it contributes to the profound distrust that the American people have in government. It is absolutely chilling that the IRS was singling out conservative groups for extra review.
Reed Epstein of Politico is with us. Reed, I want to try and dig in here to exactly what we know about what happened here. First of all, can you describe for us these 501c4 groups that they were applying for this status? This status is supposed to be for social welfare groups. And why was the IRS looking into these applications in the first place?
Well, that's, you know, the $64,000 question is why some of these, the IRS gave sort of an extra look or required some of these Tea Party groups to jump through extra hoops to get there to sort of receive nonprofit status. But if you remember, back in 2009, 2010, 2011, there were a lot of Tea Party groups that were springing up all over the country. And the way the law is written is that you can be a social welfare organization and qualify for nonprofit status, provided that you don't directly engage in sort of political campaigns, and that is sort of that's a broad definition that applies to groups some of the larger groups like President Obama's political arm, Organizing for Action, is organized under the 501c4 part of the tax law, which allows them to take unlimited contributions without having to disclose their donors. These Tea Party groups were applying for the same type of status.
But those are very political organizations. So
wouldn't
that warrant IRS investigation, whether right or left in their political leanings?
Of course, they're political organizations. But the way that the law is sort of written and has traditionally been enforced is if you don't say, vote for Tom Ashbrook, then you're not a political organization. If you can be a social welfare organization if you say, for instance, say back particular issues without backing a particular candidate, traditionally that's been considered to be social welfare and not necessarily political.
And what the IRS is saying, look, Congress gave us this law. It's fuzzy. We're trying to do our job. But is anybody trying to justify the extra scrutiny given to conservative groups?
No. And there's a number of ironies in this story. One is that there certainly had been people in Congress calling for this type of scrutiny into groups, but into more the larger groups like the Karl Rove operation and President Obama's group. There hadn't been a lot of calls for some of these smaller groups that don't necessarily have the types of lawyers that the ones that are bringing in millions and millions of dollars do, which is why it was so much more troubling for those groups to apply for the status when they would receive some of these questionnaires from the IRS about sort of what sort of literature they were handing out at their meetings, what type of things they were posting on social media, et cetera, et cetera.
The Treasury Department looking into this through their Inspector General, their report leaked, and your outfit, Politico, reporting on those leaks, the Inspector General concluding that IRS agents were not partisan. Now, how could you give extra scrutiny to Tea Party and Patriot groups and not be partisan?
And that's among the things that is going to have to be sorted out. Certainly the Inspector General's report that came out last night answered a lot of questions, but it also raised a lot of new questions, and we're going to see we're going to see a lot of the IRS officials hauled up to Capitol Hill for hearings. The House is holding a hearing on Friday. It looks like there's going to be another one next Wednesday, which top IRS officials are going to have to answer for a lot of what took place and a lot of what's in the Inspector General's report.
But is the way this has been framed in public accurate? I mean, your colleagues reporting from the Inspector General that only about 15% of the potential cases had the terms Tea Party and Patriots or 912 in their organization name. So what does that mean?
We don't know yet sort of what the answer to that question is, whether we know that the IRS officials themselves have come out and said that extra scrutiny was given to some of these groups. Lois Lerner, an IRS official who was sort of the face of this story on Friday when it first came out, said that officials in Cincinnati, in the IRS office in Cincinnati, who were tasked with making sure that some of these groups were properly receiving the status, were over aggressive on particular groups from the right, and we've since seen reporting that groups on the left that call themselves progressive or in some form of the word progress didn't receive quite as much scrutiny. The story is still relatively early. As Washington scandals go, it feels like it has a long way to go.
Everybody's saying they want to look into this, though. Who's going to look into it? Eric Holder, Attorney General, saying yesterday he's ordered an investigation. Here's the Attorney General.
I think, as everyone can agree, if not criminal, they were certainly outrageous and unacceptable, but we are examining the facts to see if there were criminal violations.
The AG there, but here, California Republican Congressman, Chairman of the House Oversight Committee, arch critic of the Obama administration, Daryl Issa, accusing the IRS of purposefully targeting the president's political enemies. He talked with Charlie Rose on CBS's This Morning.
How dare the administration imply that they're going to get to the bottom of it? This was the targeting of the president's political enemies, effectively, and lies about it during the election year so that it wasn't discovered till afterwards. The fact is, this is the kind of investigation that has to be open and transparent to the American people.
Watergate scale is the label that's being thrown around. Reed, what do you make of that? Is that fair?
It's a little early to call it Watergate. Certainly, just remember, as we all know from our Nixon history, a lot of what went on in Watergate and in the aftermath was directed from the White House and from the Oval Office. It seems in this case that it was more of an instance of the president not necessarily knowing what's going on. There's only two political appointees at the IRS, and they both were appointed during the Bush administration. So it's not as if the president's men, it's a case of all the president's men pulling the levers at the IRS. But what we are going to see is we're going to see a number of competing investigations. The Justice Department is going to do one. The House Republicans are certainly going to do one. It wouldn't surprise to see the president appoint some sort of an independent arbiter to look into this case as well, because you have Democrats calling for that almost as a way to ward off More partisan investigations that might come from Republicans.
Well, it's big and hot right now. Reed Epstein, White House reporter for Politico. Thanks for being with us, Reed.
Thank you, Tom.
With us right now from Waco, Texas, is Toby Marie Walker, president of the Waco Tea Party, one of the groups targeted by the IRS. Toby Marie, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What was your group's experience? What happened?
Well, we applied originally in July of 2010 for tax-exempt status. And we were originally told, you know, it'd be a few months because they're running behind. And then a few months came and went. Then in February of 2012, we received a letter from the IRS that was intrusion on overload. And there were questions on there that were impossible to answer, demands that were impossible to comply with. And that's when we got the ACLJ and our Congressman Bill Flores involved. Then we went back and forth with the IRS on the questions and what some of the information that they wanted. And ultimately, in the end, March of this year, we received our status.
And you got the 501c4 tax-exempt status finally, but it took a long time.
Yes, it took us from almost 3 years. And we feel that we were targeted because of the questions that were asked of us. We feel that our rights were obviously violated, especially our First Amendment rights. And it also put a big damper on our operations because we're a small organization. We're not, a big organization out of D.C.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the uproar over the IRS and its Tea Party inquiries. We will also look later in this hour at the Justice Department snooping on the Associated Press, the AP. Toby Marie Walker joins us from Waco, Texas. She's president of the Waco Tea Party, one of the groups targeted by the IRS there. Howard Glickman joins us in just a moment. Toby Marie, you said that the IRS put to you a bunch of questions that were, difficult to answer or impossible or overwhelming. Like what?
Well, for one example, they asked us to send a list of everyone that we had a close relationship to that was either a political candidate or in a political party. And when we asked the IRS, well, can you define for us what, one, a close relationship is, and two, when are they a political candidate? Because some of the incumbents, they're office holders and candidates at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They told us, we'll send a list of everyone you know and the relationships, because this is subjective, and then we'll let you know.
Okay.
Then they asked us for things like donor lists, which C4s do not have to give that, or members list.
Mm-hmm.
They asked us for every interview, a hard copy of every media interview and every media mention, whether we are participated in or not, and sent it to them. Well, that would have required, thousands of boxes of paperwork. So some of the questions they also asked us were crystal ball questions. They wanted us to predict what we were going to do in the future as far as people that might want to run for office or associations or things like that, events. Well, they don't issue us crystal balls. That's impossible to answer under penalty of perjury.
Yep.
You want to be honest, but you can't. How do you honestly predict the future?
Well, on the honesty front, this is a status for social welfare organizations.
Is that what you really are?
Aren't you a political organization? Honestly?
No, honestly, we are not. We don't endorse candidates. We don't support candidates. We don't donate to them. We don't run ads for them. We're a mom-and-pop grassroots organization. The majority of what we do is educational. We do watchdogging on our county level, our city level. We teach civics. We talk about the Constitution. We bring people in, subject matter experts on policy. So,
when you look around, you're a smart lady, Toby Marie. When you look around, there's some very big 501c4s.
Yes.
Some are conservatives. Some are liberal. There's plenty of both.
Yes.
And they've got anonymous money. You're civically interested. Is that a good idea, the anonymous money here? Can you see where the IRS might be or the...
I agree there should be scrutiny. But scrutiny and violating the law and violating your civil rights are two different things. And if you do that and step outside the bounds of the law, then that is where we need to have a lot more oversight and prevention of this ever happening again.
Toby Marie Walker in Waco, Texas. Stand by there with the Waco Tea Party. I want to welcome into our conversation from Kensington, Maryland, Howard Glickman, resident fellow at the Urban Institute, editor of the Tax Policy Center's blog, Tax Vox, with a big view on Washington, politics, the IRS. Howard, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think of what's going on in this furor over the IRS and what has gone on in their investigations?
Well, let me say two things about it. The first thing is the IRS clearly was out of line. The idea that Ms. Walker's group had to wait 3 years to get a decision from the service about whether they could have tax exemptions.
It's a long time.
Is a long time, and it really is out of line. However, as you look at the Inspector General's report that everybody's been waiting for, there's a lot less here than we have been led to believe. It turns out that of the 300 organizations that were targeted for extra review, only about 100 of them had Tea Party or Patriot or such in the names. The other 200 didn't. We don't know who they were, but they weren't Tea Party groups. It turns out that no group had its request for 501c4 status denied, not a single one. And there's no evidence from this investigation, at least, from the Treasury Department investigation, that there was any political influence on any of this at all.
Well, I'm looking at a story here from 2011 that says three groups were denied. This Emerge America in Nevada, Maine, Massachusetts, though this one does not look like a conservative group. It looks like a liberal group, I'd say, but it looks like some were denied, Howard.
According to this report from the Treasury Department of the ones that they reviewed, now they didn't look at every one, they did a representative sample of the ones that they reviewed. Not a single one was denied. They said that 23 of them, I think, withdrew their requests. But they of the representative sample they looked at, they found that none were denied.
Toby Marie, do you know of any Tea Party groups who were ultimately, now the wait is way too long, everybody acknowledged, but were anyone that you know denied its status ultimately?
Not yet. There are still some pending. And I know that there were a lot more than that number targeted because I've talked to them. And I know that there were a lot more than that who just gave up because they were inundated. These are small organizations. We're not talking about a big organization with staff and millions of dollars.
I mean, not all of them are small, right? Karl Rove's organizations are not small.
No, that one isn't. But I'm talking about the Tea Party groups that are that they're talking about right now.
Okay.
Those groups are small organizations, less than, they're tiny, small, not compared to D.C. and in the Beltway. So if you're running, 10,000 or less a year, there needs to be a very different criterion and maybe even a different tax status. But to what we're missing here is it's not the number. If it happens to one group and one group is targeted, one group's civil rights is violated, one group is being treated outside the law, then we should all be worried because this is America and we don't do these things here.
Yeah. Howard Gleckman, why do you think we ended up with, these instructions to look out for the words Tea Party or Patriot, but not for, I don't know what it would be on the other side, Emerge we see in this one, or Progressive this or Progressive that. How could that happen, Howard?
Okay, so we don't know that. I mean, this is one of the things that everybody is drawing to a conclusion about. We don't know whether or not they identified other groups, whether they had other screens. We don't know. The report doesn't say. It interestingly enough, in this, when it breaks this down, it simply breaks it down into groups identified as Tea Party, those with 912 in the name, those with Patriots in the name, and then those identified as other. And when other is two-thirds of the application surveyed, you've got to scratch your head and say, well, who is the other? And we don't know. The other thing is the woman from Waco talks about her civil rights. She didn't have to apply for 501c4 status. Nobody made her do it. Her organization made a decision that it wanted that status. One of the reasons that many of these groups applied for, and I can't speak for hers, of course, but one of the reasons that many of these groups applied for C4 status was specifically because that provision of the law allowed them to accept anonymous campaign contributions. It was a convenient mechanism from a provision of the law that was never intended for this purpose, for them to run political money from contributors.
That's
in an anonymous way.
You're making on a lot of groups.
Well, just it is interesting, though. I mean, of all the statuses,
but you don't know why we applied for that. You're assuming.
What is your why did you apply for it, Toby?
We did apply for it because there's a number of reasons. One of the reasons, and when you have that tax status, you get discounts for services. And when you're running a budget like mine, every $100 counts.
You mean
every
like from a print, from printers or
printers vendors? Yes.
Okay.
The other reason is that it does give you the credibility that you have done everything right and that you have followed the law because you have received that status. There is a little bit of a stigma if you don't have some kind of a legal status.
But there are other status that you could go for. Did it increase your fundraising capacity to be 501c4? Did that, the fact that it would be anonymous, did that help on fundraising?
Yes, it did, and the anonymous funding did help because, like in the NAACP versus Alabama, we had people being targeted because they were part of the Tea Party, because the media was painting people as extremists and other nonsense, and they didn't want to lose their jobs. They didn't want to have to be out there. And to say, well, why did you don't have to have that. Well, you don't have to be a reporter. You don't have to be a policeman. We live in a country that has freedom.
No, you've got the right under the law to go for it.
Right. So I don't like that. Well, we don't have to do that. Well,
what's the problem, Howard?
So the problem, Tom, is that the law – let's go back. The 501c4 status – was something that was created in 1913. It was created 100 years ago, and it was created basically so that civic associations, community organizations, could get tax exempt status. For 98 of those years, that was essentially what happened. And then, starting in the late 90s, and particularly after the Citizens United case, there was this enormous increase in requests for these applications by political groups. The legal standard...
After the Citizens United decision in 2010 by the Supreme Court.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Because what happened here was the Citizens United case made it possible for unions and large corporations to give unlimited amounts of money. However, under the mechanism that most of them were using at the time, these so-called Section 527 organizations, they had to disclose who they were.
Yeah.
So what happened was they had some clever lawyers who looked around and tried to find a mechanism so that not only could they give unlimited amounts of money, but they could give it anonymously. And there sitting in the code was this very obscure section of 501c4, again, created basically for community groups. And these organizations saw the loophole and they used it. And the great advantage, again, I can't speak for the Waco group, but the great advantage of many of these groups was their ability to receive anonymous contributions.
But they have the right under the law to do this. I mean, under the Supreme Court ruling and the law of the land since 1913 and this interpretation, they can do it.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. And let me finish what I was going to say.
Yeah,
and the
yeah.
point is that if you're going to apply for 501c4 status, the legal standard is that the majority of what you do can't be political. That's the
majority
standard.
Of what we do.
So
is
it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that the IRS was asking people whether they were political.
Right.
They're
obliged to do.
They're asking questions.
Standard under the law, the services.
I got it, Toby Marie. How do you think the IRS should then determine whether or not the majority of a group like yours, whether the majority is political or not? How would they do that? That's not a dead easy thing to do.
It's actually quite easy.
It is?
You do it by your time and your resource division. And we supplied that. We welcome that kind of scrutiny. We supplied that to the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
What we're upset about is the targeting, the illegal questions that they asked, and going outside the scope of a 1024 application. That is illegal. Would we tell the NAACP back in the 1960s, hey, we don't care. You are going to have to release your donors and your members so that you could be targeted by the KKK.
Toby,
absolutely not.
Toby Marie, we've got it. Stand by. I've got listeners who want to jump in here. Let me go to Dothan, Alabama. Edward's calling. Edward, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that this is nothing new by the IRS. Either the media has amnesia because or something, because all during the 60s, my groups in Detroit, Michigan, were targeted. We were militant African-American groups. We were targeted by the IRS, and I was a business owner, mm-hmm. and I had a bookstore, which a lot of activists would gather around the bookstore. The IRS practically closed my store down. They were one step from closing me down when I showed an article in the paper about this to my agent, and he didn't know. He was an IRS agent. He had no clue what they were doing. The IRS has always done this. This is nothing that's absolutely new.
Edward, you give us some very personal and keen historical perspective there. Howard, how about it? I mean, after the Nixon era, there was this sort of idea that we were supposed to get away from that. What has it been true historically that it's been used this way, and what about in recent decades?
I can't speak for what happened to this gentleman back in the 1960s. I mean, we know. I mean, it's well-known history that when Richard Nixon was president, this sort of thing was being directed from the Oval Office. He had his enemies list, and he was using the IRS to help punish people he perceived as political enemies. We know that administrations in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, and maybe even later, were targeting civil rights groups. We know the FBI certainly was. You know, that's not a surprise. You know, there is no evidence of at this point, and, you know, we'll see where this investigation goes, but at least based on the evidence we've seen so far, there's absolutely no evidence that any of this was politically directed.
Well, everybody's watching that space very closely. I mean, and Will, Sean in New Haven, Connecticut. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have issue with, you know, the comment that people's civil rights were violated. These aren't individuals that were asking to not pay tax because they don't earn, you know, enough income to pay tax. These were businesses that basically put names out that sounded like they wanted to have some political influence. And in my opinion, it's a good place to start for the IRS when they're looking for people trying to get away from paying taxes.
Well, I mean, they're not businesses, but you're right. The IRS is supposed to see if they're political groups or not. But what about targeting one end of the political spectrum, Sean? What about that?
I'm not sure what the other names were, but I don't know if it's, you know, it's hard to say without seeing the whole list of 300.
I hope if there were other filters. Toby Marie, at the end of the day, how do we have groups like this? And the Supreme Court says we can. And how do we look into it to make sure that they're not political? You say yours isn't. Okay. But how do we make sure of that when there's so much anonymous money, hundreds of millions of dollars rolling around? We want to be sure that these aren't primarily political. How do we do that, Toby Marie?
I think that what you have to do is you have to do exactly what we've done, and that you divide out your division of time and resources spent, and if a certain percentage of that is above that amount, then it would not qualify. That is the easiest way, and we did that, and we proved that the majority of what we do is not, you know, in the political electoral process.
Yeah, Howard, what's your formula here for getting this right? If it was done wrong this time out, how do we get it right?
You know, it would be nice if the legal formula were that simple, if you could simply calculate if, you know, $50 plus one was spent for other activities. But it's not that simple. If you look at the law is extremely vague about this. And part of the problem is, how do you define political activity? So she said, you know, most of her is for not political activity. But,
yeah.
But what does political activity mean? Does it mean specifically endorsing a candidate? Does it say candidate Jones is a bum and he supports all those things you disagree with and write him and say that he's a bum? Is that political?
What about maybe the law itself needs to be clarified, tightened, or something, Howard?
I would go another step. I think what offends the woman from Waco, what offends many people, is that the IRS appears to be regulating political speech. And unfortunately, that's the job that the law has given them. I don't think anybody at the IRS wants to do this. But we have put the IRS in a position where it's regulating political speech, and that's an untenable position for the IRS.
So maybe just take that job right out of the hands of the IRS. We will follow the investigations. Howard Gleckman with the Tax Policy Center's blog, TaxVox. Thanks very much for being with us, Howard.
Glad to be with you.
And Toby Marie Walker at the Waco Tea Party in Waco, Texas. Thank you, Toby Marie.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll look at justice snooping on the Associated Press. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And more uproar this week over the Justice Department and its secret snooping into 2 months of Associated Press phone records as part of a sweeping investigation of government leaks about a failed al-Qaeda terror plot last year, published details of a CIA operation in Yemen that foiled an al-Qaeda plot to bomb a U.S.-bound passenger jet, posed a serious threat to national security, Attorney General Eric Holder said yesterday. But his department's investigation, say many critics, posed a serious threat to the freedom of the press. With us from New York City, famed First Amendment attorney Floyd Abrams. His high-profile clients have included the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, journalists Nina Totenberg, Judith Miller, and Matthew Cooper in Protecting Confidential Sources. He's a partner at Cahill, Gordon & Reindel. His forthcoming book out June 4th is Friend of the Court on the Front Lines with the First Amendment. Floyd Abrams, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
The attorney general says this was a dire national security threat. They couldn't just let it pass. They had to figure out what was going on with this leak. What do you say?
Well, I guess the first thing I say is that there are other ways to try to deal with issues like this than sort of ransacking the telephone records of one of America's, you know, great publishing institutions. The usual way, and the way that the Attorney General's guidelines require them to act in most cases, is to talk to the AP, try to persuade them to turn over information. They probably wouldn't have, and it probably would have gone to court, and we would have had a judge, an independent decision maker out there, weighing the First Amendment interest against whatever interest the Attorney General believes was at risk here. Here they didn't do that. Here they took the position that even telling them would so interfere with their investigation that they had to behave in what the Attorney General called this aggressive way. Well, you know, my view is that on the basis of what we can tell so far, I'm just not persuaded. And I think it's particularly unfortunate that, I mean, the AP, after all, played the game the right way. They withheld their story for some time. They only went ahead and published it after they were told by the government itself that it was okay to do it. So, you know, I think it comes with particularly poor grace for them to behave in this way. Beyond that, I'm concerned about a broader picture that the administration has engaged in one after another leak investigation, more than, you know, all the other leak investigations of other administrations. And unless we're suddenly having, you know, an explosion of dangerous leaks, we're having an explosion of dangerous government investigations.
Your former client, the New York Times, in its editorial talking about what it describes as a chilling zeal for investigating leaks in the Obama administration. This one looks like a fishing expedition for sources, an effort to frighten off whistleblowers, they write. I mean, let's look at this. Quite to the contrary of going and asking the AP, you know, for some cooperation, they laid down a secret, dragnet? They got phone records in and out on work phones, home phones, cell phone records, almost 100 people here. It's being said all over the place that this may be one of the most sweeping secret investigations of this kind or snooping on the press ever. Do you buy that characterization of it, Floyd Abrams?
I think it's an absolutely fair characterization, and it's over a two-month period. And while they may not have done this every day over that period, we're talking about all these phones in the office and at home over a major period. I mean, the necessary effect of that, I mean, the absolute inherent effect of that is that the Department of Justice now sits with an enormous amount of information about who called in and who called out, about stories having nothing to do with this investigation. And while they tell us, you know, they're not going to look at it and they don't care about that stuff, you know, that's not the way we behave in a democratic First Amendment protected society. I mean, we generally proceed on the basis we wouldn't need a First Amendment otherwise, that the government is capable of and sometimes does act very badly indeed with information, let alone information they shouldn't have. So it's a very major step, very major, for them to go in and, in effect, act no different than if they had sent FBI personnel right into the AP offices and said, give us your phone records.
Yeah, just turn them over. A big, great big pile of them.
Same thing.
Here was, I've got the AP executive editor, Kathleen Carroll, Floyd. This was on MSNBC's Morning Joe talking about the AP's reaction to the Justice Department collecting all those phone records.
We're distressed that the Justice Department felt the need to seize our records and not tell us about it, and certainly distressed, as our CEO said in his protest to the Justice Department, that the scope of the inquiry is so huge.
So huge. It's got everybody's attention. Now here, if I may, Floyd Abrams, here's the White House spokesman, Jay Carney, parsing this, trying to acknowledge, oh, well, there's a leak problem, but there's a constitution, the journalism rights here. Let's listen.
It is important to protect our national security classified information. It is also, in the president's view, essential to allow journalists to be able to pursue in an unfettered way investigative journalism.
Okay, but the AG, Eric Holder, came down very strongly talking about the seriousness of the leak. Here he was in a press conference yesterday.
This was a very serious leak, and a very, very serious leak. I've been a prosecutor since 1976, and I have to say that this is among, if not the most serious, it is within the top two or three most serious leaks that I've ever seen. It put the American people at risk, and that is not hyperbole. It put the American people at risk.
Floyd Abrams, there's the Attorney General of the United States putting up the flagpole about as high as you can go, the threat level here, to justify what went on. Could it have been just so high that it would justify this kind of dragnet?
Well, what he didn't say is why they couldn't, in effect, have allowed an independent decision maker, a judge, make that decision. I mean, I don't know, and we can't know, how important this or that is. But what we can know is the procedure they used, the seizure without notice. The amount of documents that they've seized, the nature, the very sensitive nature of the documents they've seized. Now, it may just be that they didn't want to go through a long investigation. I mean, if this had gone to court, things in court take time. But that's not a good reason when the First Amendment's involved and when the ability of the press to function is involved. I mean, see, it seems to me this is the sort of thing, if some other country had done, that the State Department would be condemning it on human rights grounds. Mm. And we shouldn't be in that area.
Super First Amendment attorney Floyd Abrams is with us. We're looking at the Justice Department's snooping into Associated Press phone records, a whole lot of them. Lots of callers here. Paul in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Floyd Abrams. What do you think, Paul?
Hi, Tom. I've been an Obama supporter, but I'm disgusted and outraged. This is intimidation, pure and simple. They've shredded the Constitution. They've really done everything that their worst Republican critics have said they've done. They've intimidated reporters and leakers. They've murdered U.S. citizens. And
murdered U.S. citizens? Oh, you're talking about Al-Awlaki's son?
With no due process. They've used the IRS for political purposes.
Well,
it's Nixonian, and I'll be pleased to see the Republican House dig into this. This administration has done more damage than Nixon to liberty, and I think they should be held to account.
Let's hold that one right there. We got Floyd Abrams, who's got enough historical perspective here to weigh that last claim. What about it, Floyd? The Nixonian charges. You hear Paul's fury here, and it's understandable.
Yeah.
But what? Give us some relative weight of scandal.
Well, I think the question on most of the matters Paul mentioned is how high this went and with what level of deliberateness. I mean, that certainly is a key question in the whole IRS situation, which to me is by its nature potentially the worst of all the civil liberties threatening activities of the administration. I mean, the Nixon administration aimed at political enemies, and we ought to make very sure that we know what the IRS was doing, even though it obviously focused on conservative groups, that at least it didn't come from the White House. And if it didn't, that would be a very big distinction from anything in the Nixon administration. I mean, so far as we know, the president doesn't have an enemies list, which President Nixon had. But to your broader point, Paul, I mean, look, I'm concerned too. I'm also an Obama voter. I'm very concerned that particularly in the national security area, and an area that I take very seriously, and I think I may disagree with you on drones about, but particularly in a national security area, however seriously you take the dangers, you have to work within a constitutional framework, and you can't interfere with the ability of the press to function. I don't know whether the intention here was or was not to chill further, call them whistleblowers, or people in the government revealing information, or whether these are just career guys and the Department of Justice doing what they perceive as their job. But there's got to be someone out there. There's got to be someone in this administration who is overseeing these various civil liberties relating problems, because they are, as Paul said, if this were Nixon, or if this were a Republican president, a lot of us who voted for President Obama would be absolutely up in arms. And we should be no less so because we happen to agree with the administration on other issues.
Let's go to Sam in Lexington, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think the comparison of Obama to Nixon is ridiculous because Nixon was a bumbler. He was an amateur compared to Obama, and I think we should give credit where credit is due because Obama is handling the situation much better. He's violating the First Amendment with impunity, and all his supporters, I mean, I'm glad to hear that some of the supporters think maybe he should be taken to task for it, but by and large, he's portrayed as a protector of the Constitution and a great liberal president. So I think you have to really acknowledge his ability to handle the media and handle the message, because he gets away with it consistently, and he got reelected.
Sam, appreciate your call. Floyd Abrams, the sarcasm needle being pinned there by Sam.
Look, I think this week things changed. I mean, this week was a perfect storm for this administration. I mean, sort of one of these, everything that could go wrong is, or everything that is being revealed about what has been going wrong is starting to come out. And I do think that, in all fairness, that you know, the liberal press, the New York Times today, for example, in saying that, you know, it's not prepared to give the president the benefit of the doubt. And I, too, in this area, am not. We've had too many leak investigations to do so, and the notion of simply entrusting to the Department of Justice itself all the decision-making power here seems to me wrong, and something that an administration that is First Amendment sensitive would be trying to avoid in one way or another.
I'm trying to figure out here what balance there might be between, on the one hand, a kind of rage at leaks. All administrations get upset with them, and this one has been very sensitive, versus national security fear. I mean, they did disrupt an al-Qaeda plot, we're told, that could have brought down a U.S.-bound jetliner out of Yemen. So here's Attorney General Holder saying this is on a kind of epic scale of national security threat. Could some sort of technology or some network that was revealed through this leak that what might have put another passenger jet at risk? Does that?
Yeah, I think what they're saying is that at the put aside the exemplary, in my view, behavior of the AP in holding the story,
mm-hmm.
but that at the time the leak occurred, it could have resulted in someone's death, an agent's death. I mean, yes, that does make it serious. The Attorney General said that they'd interviewed 550 people, including himself. That suggests that they are indeed taking it seriously. So this doesn't have to be, and I have no reason to think this is a sort of a made up, feigned matter for the Department of Justice. Nonetheless, the notion of them, you know, just running off to the phone companies and saying turn over all their records for, you know, for these 20 different areas over this 2-month period, home phones and office phones and the like, is so much of what I believe is an overreaction. I also have to wonder, when this is all over,
mm-hmm.
are we going to find out that they really know who the leaker is, and that the important thing for them now is getting evidence to convict, you know, to prosecute the leaker?
Well, the chill is out there one way or the other. With all you tell them that the biggest news organization in the country has had its phone records, you know, all sucked up for that. Who's going to want to talk to a reporter?
Well, yeah. Look, that's the key, and that's the central risk, and I'm afraid likelihood of all this. I mean, look, in the ordinary situation where you have it litigated in court, and let's say the press loses, one thing it hasn't lost is the ability to say to its sources, look, you know, we really tried very hard. We did all we could.
Yeah.
And in some cases, of course, journalists go to jail to protect those sources. Here, well, what is the lesson? The lesson is that the government has the power to just find out by going to telephone records.
Just sweep in and do it. Floyd Abrams' new book, Friend of the Court, on the front lines with the First Amendment, will be out next month. Floyd Abrams, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.